Welcome back to Slightly Foxed and this month's literary expedition off the beaten track. Last time we discussed writing about royalty. This time, for one of our occasional episodes about individual writing lives, we're going to be talking to a novelist who's made her career writing very observantly about the rest of us, and that's Dame Margaret Drabble. We'll meet her in a moment. Meanwhile, Slightly Foxed co-editors Gail Perkis and Hazelwood are here with their colleague Anna Kirk. My name is Philippa Lamb, and I'm going to issue the usual warning about noises off from the editorial team working way around us here in Hoxton Square in East London. And it's March now, Hazel, looking quite spring-like in Square.
It's looking very spring-like. The leaves are coming out and, you know, it feels as if life's beginning again, really.
Uplifting.
Yes.
And Anna, we are right on the brink of announcing the winner of the first Biography Prize, aren't we? But we don't have it because we're recording this podcast before that result is known.
Yes, so in just a few days' time, we'll know who the winner will be. But by the time this airs, the Slightly Foxed Best Biography Prize Award winner will be out there in the world. So please do go on our website for the result.
Before I introduce Margaret, let me just mention that our reading from the Slightly Foxed Quarterly Archive this time is taken from a piece by Nigel Andrew. It's about an exceptional, but now perhaps little-known English novelist, Elizabeth Jenkins. As usual, we will have reading recommendations from everyone at the end of the podcast. But now, on to today's discussion and our guest, Dame Margaret Drabble. Thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Now, I hope I have this right. 19 novels?
That's correct.
Biographies, editing the Oxford Companion to English Literature, there is a lot to talk about. I thought we might start with the novels. I'm wondering how you'd characterise them.
I think they're just novels about social life and how we live now. On the whole, they're set in the present, and the present has moved along with me as I've aged, so my characters age as I do. I write about what's around me.
And you began in the 60s?
I began in the 60s. I think my first novel was published in 1963, but you may correct me.
Summer Birdcage, I think.
That was certainly my first novel, yes.
Am I right in thinking you had young children then? How did you come to write a novel?
Well, I wrote my first novel while I was expecting my first child, which was a good time to be writing because you've got much else to do.
You have time.
Yes. But I wrote the second while expecting my second and the third while expecting my third. So that kind of fitted in with the pregnancies. And then I stopped having children, but I did go on writing novels.
Paint us a picture of the literary world then, because you must have known a lot of the big name female writers that we think of now.
Well, I didn't, because I was writing in my kitchen. You know, I was just all by myself. I was an actress also, but I was very much stuck in the kitchen. I got to know people about 10 years after that. I began to meet people like Lessing and Nell Dunn and Edna O'Brien, but that was after I'd been published 2 or 3 novels.
So you were an established writer by the time you started moving in those sort of circles. I think, like them, you were writing a lot about the experiences of women.
I was, and it wasn't quite yet the fashionable thing to do. I think it's now called the second wave of feminism, a phrase which I'd never heard till somebody told me about it. And it was the early 60s, and it was people like Sylvia Plath, Nell Dunn, writers of my age or a little older, who were beginning to write about women's affairs.
And what did you think of their work?
Well, I didn't read Doris till I published 3 or 4 novels, and then I cheekily wrote her a fan letter and we became friends. But I'd already published 4, so I know I wasn't influenced in my early books. I think I was in my later ones. Nell Dunn I knew from very early on. Margaret Forster I met while I was doing my Oxford-Cambridge interview, but we hardly ever met. We had a kind of relationship at a distance, and I loved her books. But it was strange, the people you saw and the people you didn't see. Some of us had children, and that really constrained our social lives. You didn't go to literary parties because you had to get a babysitter. It was very much a world where you improvised your own life.
You were very successful pretty well straight away.
I was successful quite early, not in terms of huge sales and money, but I did have a very, very happy start.
Yes. And a high profile.
I think people say that women writers have a terrible time, but in those days they were actually looking out for them. They positively encouraged young women. I mean, Edna had a very easy time as well, Edna O'Brien.
Yeah.
Because she was attractive, she was sociable, and people longed to see her.
It's interesting you say that, because I think that's not generally felt to be the case. So we imagine that now is the time we're bringing women writers to the fore.
I think it was a very easy ride. There was a rising wave. I think far more books are being published now, so they get less attention. Yes. I think we got more than our fair share of attention. We shouldn't say that, but I think we were lucky, you know.
Well, also the advent of, you know, the paperback meant that the novel was affordable.
Yes.
And I think, you know, middle class affluence meant that people, and particularly women, could afford to go and buy books.
I mean, those early Penguins were really cheap, and I still get correspondence from people who say they read them when they were sort of at 20 and still have the fading copy.
It's funny how the Penguin designs, they're so distinctive.
My early jackets by Penguin were Quentin Blake, and they were so beautiful.
Lucky you.
And I know, well, we were both very, very young, and I've never written him a letter of appreciation. Every time I think of him, I think I must write to him now before while we're both still alive. But they were just completely charming jackets, yes, and I've still got the early ones, yeah.
What was it like, Margaret, when you first sat down to write Summer Burgage? Had it been in your mind for a long time? Or?
Yeah, I was stuck at home, and my first husband was out every evening because he was on stage every evening, and I had nothing to do, really. I was very at a loss to how to amuse myself, and so I wrote a book, which I think many women have done.
Did you ever feel you were part of a movement?
Well, not until I'd published a book. I felt very alone to begin with. I felt very much that I was doing this, as I say, on the kitchen table. But then when I began to meet other people who were, like Margaret Forster, in my position with small children, I realised there was a movement, but it hadn't actually got itself recognised.
Do you have a sense of who, or did you then have a sense of who was reading your work?
It was people like me, of whom there were millions. It was a time when a lot of women were educated but expected to be housewives. And these were the people who still write to me. They say, I'm 80 now, but I remember reading your books when I was having children. And I think there was this captive readership of educated women who'd got degrees and done very well at college, but had never had a job.
Yes. And of course, that was a time when employers could happily turn to a woman, a married woman, and say, well, now you're married, off you go.
Yeah, exactly. And nowadays, I feel sorry for young mothers because they're expected to have a job. Where will they find time to write their novels, I wonder? Mm-hmm. And for me, there was kind of spare time because of being at home with the children, who did go to sleep quite early in the evening. It was a different rhythm of life.
There were sort of nice loose playgroups and things, weren't there?
I founded a playgroup. I was tremendously proud of that. In Stratford-upon-Avon, there was absolutely no provision for the children of actors and actresses. It was very, very useful. You had three mornings a week when the children went and played with one another.
Yes.
So it all went very well in your 20s, didn't it? And by your, 30s, you divorced your first husband, you have these three children. When did you realise you were writing for a living?
Before I divorced my first husband, because I realised I could manage on my own, thank you very much. I mean, I realised I could support the children, buy the house.
Did you have an agent?
I didn't have an agent for my first three books. And then I realised I was actually getting slightly out of my depth with paperwork. And I then did acquire an agent, to the rage of my publisher, but I think absolutely wisely from my point of view, who looked after me very, very well. Your agent looks after you better than your publisher, is my feeling. The publishers have a lot of other people to publish, but your agent really loves you.
It's a very personal relationship with an agent,
isn't it?
It
really is, and if you have a good one, you know you can rely on them to be on your side. Your publisher is not always on your side, but your agent has to be.
And talking to agents, they embed themselves in some of their writers' lives. They become involved in all their loves and life and personal matters as well. I thought it was just a working relationship, but it's much closer, isn't it?
It's often very personal.
Yeah. Now, you were writing biography and non-fiction at the same time, weren't you?
My first biography was a tremendous struggle. It was Arnold Bennett, Life of Arnold Bennett. And I was signed up to do that by my publisher, George Weidenfeld, who said, he did actually say something like, it's time you wrote a proper book. Because he didn't take fiction seriously at all. So I said, OK, I'll do Arnold Bennett. I don't think he knew who Arnold Bennett was.
Why did you choose Arnold Bennett?
Well, because my family were from the Potteries, and there was a sort of history that we were connected with him in some way. My aunt's middle name was Bennett. Very slender evidence. And we had all the books in the house. And so I read them and I liked them very much. And he was slightly out of fashion as a writer, but that made it all the more interesting for me.
But a totally different writing process.
A totally different writing process. And I wasn't very good at it, to tell you the truth. I mean, it was ridiculous that his papers were in New York. How could I get to New York with three small children?
You know? Yes, so what did you do?
I just avoided the issue completely. I relied on published sources, though I did get to know his widow very well, and indeed his daughter. So I did find out things that other people didn't know through the family.
And there were others, weren't there? Gail and I were talking about Angus Wilson.
Yes. Now, that was a serious biography in that I did a lot of work on that.
Because he was obviously read very widely when he was being published, but he then dropped out of sight and then was revived later. But his star seems to have faded again.
He wasn't revived very successfully. No. I mean, and I just don't know whether there'll be another second coming. Mm.
I know very little about him, I'm afraid to say.
Well, he was the big writer when I was a young writer, and I was tremendously pleased to meet him and become friends with him. He was a satirist, he wrote about social life. I mean, his big success was Anglo-Saxon Attitudes, which is a brilliantly readable book about a forgery. It's about anthropology and sociology. I just love that book. But some people think they've dated. He was one of the very first gay writers before you were allowed to be gay. Gay writers now, like Alan Hollinghurst, think he was sort of two-faced.
Yes.
But in fact, he was quite out.
He did. Yes, he made no bones about it. He did very bravely.
He was very, very brave. I mean, he lived with his partner openly when it was illegal.
Yeah.
And he campaigned for homosexual equality. And in the novels, there are some very good descriptions of gay partnerships, but of course, because it was illegal, you had to tread carefully, even in fiction.
You must have found when you, I know I'm probably jumping the gun, but talking about the Oxford Companion to your literature, I mean, there you're trawling through people's reputations in a way, aren't you? Because I know you did two editions, didn't you?
Yes.
And people presumably come into it and then drop out of it. How did you decide who went in and who...
Yes, what's the process? Yeah.
Well, when I did it the first time round, it was completely my own judgment. Things were so different.
Wow,
you
gosh.
Didn't have a huge team of people.
Yes.
It was all done in triplicate typing.
Right.
And the Oxford University Press took me to the OUP offices and they said, well, this is a thing called a computer, but I don't think they're going to catch on.
and
I don't think we want you to work on one. And within a year or two, they changed their mind. But we did the whole edition without a computer.
When did the last one come out?
That was 1930-something. And that had wonderful sentences like the metaphysical poets were, and it listed their names, and there was no entries on any of them at all. And he didn't have any interest in working-class poets like John Clare. So there was a definite bias against women, against working-class ploughman poets, and against other categories that I was able to revise. But I chopped out a lot of minor Victorian novelists, theologians, and also he listed the names of everybody's horses. Just at a whim. He had Copenhagen, I think, was the horse, or was it Wellington? He had animals and all sorts of weird things.
That's strange.
General knowledge stuff
he
had. People like Philip Larkin weren't in, you know.
Yes,
But the really difficult things were when people agreed to, because I did farm out quite a lot of entries, and I farmed out William Blake to an academic in Edinburgh who never, ever did it.
Well, Hazel and I bless you practically every week because for checking facts and getting a bit of background information, I mean, it's the first port of call.
Yes, now I was just wondering, were you left to get on with it?
I was totally left to get on with it. Nobody interfered, nobody helped, and when I'd finished, they were happy with it, you know. But the next time round, when I revised it, the computer had been invented, lists had been invented, and that's when I insured my computer because I was so worried I was going to lose all this. These were early days and you could lose material very easily.
Yes.
And it was much, much more stressful to me. I discovered afterwards that one or two people I knew had been asked to do it and had declined on the grounds that it was too much like hard work and would be... But I'm always glad I did it because I learned a lot from doing it.
And did you approach it at all in any way like your fiction or your novels, coming from a novelist kind of perspective? Because actually hearing all of those references to the different people that you're including, I feel there's quite a lot of those people who crop up in your novels, in The Millstone with Rosamund working on the Elizabethan poets and kind of dropping things in, but with such a light touch, it doesn't distract from the story or the reality of what's going on, like in the kitchen or what have you. And same with quotations in The Dark Flood Rising, there's bits of Shakespeare and what have you.
I sometimes think there are too many quotations, you know. I have a great difficulty. I have a quotation for almost anything and I can't resist popping them in. But it's true that there was a sort of interaction between my fictional life and my critical life. Of course there was, yes. One fed into the other.
Yeah.
I mean, how's it been rereading the manor? Because if you don't mind me saying how old you are, you're 31. You read them, I think, in your teens, quite a lot of them in your teens, as I did, and revisiting them now. There's a lot about the tension, isn't there, between career and private life. Does it feel very current to you now?
Yeah, it absolutely does. I mean, it's still kind of issues that we are experiencing today, domestic issues, kind of navigating work and life balance and managing time.
Partners
and social life. And it's still just the same kind of chat that we're having now and quite timeless. I mean, there are certain period details that may have changed, but otherwise.
I've just finished reading The Radiant Way and A Natural Curiosity, and I was reading The Radiant Way just before the election. And there's a wonderful question and answer in that about politics. And of course, the book is set in the early 80s, isn't it? So you've got the miners' strike and you've got Thatcher and all the rest of it. And there's this question and answer where the character's trying to decide what her political views are. And I was fascinated because, yes, she supports the miners, but on the other hand, she can see that if you had an extreme socialist government, it would cause chaos. And she goes from one extreme to the other. And in the end, it's clear that really she's very middle of the road in her politics, which, of course, was precisely, you know, the outcome of the election. And that just felt so relevant to now.
A lot of the issues haven't really gone away.
No.
The details have changed, but things like what's happening to our city centres, it's a different threat to them now. But the kind of desolation that you saw in northern cities during the miners' strike is being replicated, but by different economic forces.
Yes.
Honestly, a lot of the stuff you write about is the human condition. It will be ever thus. But the questions and the problems arising around women and work and family, are you surprised they're still as present now as well? I mean, you were writing about these in the early 60s.
I think some things have changed for the better in that women now are expected and allowed to work.
Yeah.
Abortion is on the whole legalised, though it's always under threat. Women's bodily rights,
but yeah.
Not everywhere. I think our sort of sense of the body is more respectful than it used to be. But there are still huge issues. And I just find the life-work balance for mothers still. I mean, I remember Germaine Greer just saying, oh, put all your children in a kibbutz. I mean, it just isn't the answer. And I just am horrified by the amount people spend in childcare, nursery care, how you need two big incomes to support two small children. I just find the way that's gone slightly incomprehensible, like the homelessness. I can't see how we've got to where we are. So there are still big domestic problems for women.
Do you have a personal favourite of your novels?
Yes, I think my favourite novel of mine, and this always slightly annoys people because it's my longest, is The Needle's Eye, which I'm very, very fond of because I felt that in that I'd got nearest to saying my political and ethical position about life.
So for people who haven't read it...
It is a domestic novel in that it's about a woman who inherits a lot of money and doesn't really want it, and this young man falls in love with her, and it's about domestic tension, but it's also about giving up the world to profit your soul. So it's a more spiritual novel than my other novels. It ends at the Alexandra Palace with my heroine putting her hand on one of those stone lions.
This is in North London, big Victorian exhibition
huge,
palace.
Huge thing, which is now full of darts and goodness knows what. And she's looking at this lion and she says, it has weathered into identity, the beast of the people. And that was when I was full of hope that things would get better, and places like that were a sort of sign of communal spirit. So it was my novel which had hope in it. And after that, I think it got a bit knocked out of me by the fact that things didn't go on getting better.
But the humour hasn't been knocked out, has it? I mean, The Dark Flood Rises is terribly funny in places. Actually, come to that, the A Natural Curiosity with that the grisly murder, the Harrow Road, who decapitates people and ends up, it turns out he's living above one of the characters.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some really black comedy in that.
Yeah, but it is quite black, isn't
it? Yes, it is.
I think my sense of humour has got blacker over the years. And in The Dark Flood Rises, which is about, let's be honest, ageing and death.
Yes.
I mean, what do you have but sort of quite black humour about how you cope with
there's a tremendous tension in that, because you keep talking about subterranean rumblings off the coast of the islands, and... Mm-hmm. I kept waiting for a tsunami or some catastrophe to happen, and it doesn't, but it lingers as a presence.
Yeah,
kept me gripped.
It's about to happen. And of course, this book was written before climate change was quite such a hot. It has been a hot topic for a long time.
Yes.
But it's before it reached the forefront. And I wrote it during the floods of the West Country, which were really quite severe.
Yes.
And the Somerset levels?
The Somerset levels. Yes. And I used to travel through that on the train a lot. Mm. And it looked absolutely beautiful, but was clearly not a good sign of things to come.
No. I think you said writing is an illness. Do you feel that?
Yes, I kind of do. It is like an addiction or an illness. It's something that, I mean, there are some writers who just have to write every day. I'm not like that. I mean, it's not such a bad illness. Colin Wilson, who wrote The Outsider many years ago and had a terrific success when he was 21, he wrote every day of his life until he died, but didn't publish most of it. But I'm not like that at all. But it is something I turn to and I can't get away from because it is a sort of addiction.
Have you ever sort of wanted to get away from it?
Yes, I get away from it for sort of periods of time. I never used to write in August. I always used to say, we'll take August off. But yes, I'm not writing so much now as I used to.
I think it would be a very good thing, actually, if all novelists only wrote if they really couldn't help themselves. There'd be far less published and it would be of much better quality.
See, I don't have to write for money now, as some
but
writers
do.
It's an
inner compulsion that makes you...
It's
the creative spark,
isn't
it? It's
the feeling that it's what I do. It's an illness, but it's also a trade. I mean, it's a profession. It's your professional life.
Mm. And your identity as well.
It is. Yeah. Though, I mean, I think I have other identities that I'm more attached to, but it is my identity.
Mm. I mean, I know you haven't really gone in for introspection, have you? Like a lot of novelists in later life. But you produced a book called, which I haven't read, The Pattern in the Carpet.
Yes, that's just about to be reissued by Canongate, and I'm quite pleased about that, because I rather loved that book. It was meant to be a history of the jigsaw puzzle, but nobody wanted to publish a history of the jigsaw puzzle, and it turned into a memoir about my aunt and jigsaw puzzles.
It's a lifelong passion with you, jigsaw puzzles.
Yes,
is that right?
Absolutely. Now, I was talking about it over dinner last night. No, I absolutely love them.
Why?
Because you can finish them, unlike a novel, or, you know, they're finite, and if you choose or get given the right image, you learn a masterpiece very, very well. The last one I did, which I really loved, was La Grande Jatte. It was just a joy. It was huge. It was 2,000 pieces, hardly fitted on the table. But the pleasure of putting these people and the animals and the boats and the trees together in this pointillist...
Yeah.
And it was surprisingly not difficult. I mean, it was actually better than the Impressionists. Pointillism is better for a jigsaw than Impressionism.
Interesting.
Yes. But it was satisfying. And I now will never forget a detail of that.
That's not sounding like fun to me.
No, well,
but it's very satisfying.
It is very satisfying.
Because you feel that you're putting something together that can eventually be resolved.
Yes.
Can I ask you about the Booker Prize? Because I know you've never allowed your work to be put forward for it.
Yes, that's because it seemed to me that it was all getting out of hand, and I was right. I mean, I think people agree with me now that it all got a bit out of hand, and people were forever being defined as and never won the Booker, or and Booker Prize winning so-and-so.
You definitely have won it, though, wouldn't you? Well, in my view.
There was one book I might have been in for, but I don't think I would. And anyway, it was very interesting. There was a year when John Fowles and I, and I think Graham Greene, said we weren't going to get... And this seemed to me a very chic company to
very,
be in. I thought, I'll join them, rather than the runners-up. I'll join them. And since then, I've stuck to it. My publishers got quite cross with me, but I said, look, I've made this position clear. I mean, I have gone back on other things I've said I wouldn't do and done them, but I've done okay without it, so it's
You
fine.
Don't regret it?
No, I don't regret it at all. No.
What did you think about the two winners this year?
I thought it was a shame that they split it, because Margaret Atwood has had immense renown, and Bernie Evaristo is, she needed the prominent, but I think she's done fine out of it. I think both of them done fine. They were nice to each other about it, but I do think Margaret Atwood has had plenty, and she's a wonderful writer, but she's had plenty.
Yeah.
But I don't mind all that much. It's only a prize.
I'll kind of wrap this, really, by just asking you to look at your writing life so far, because, I mean, we are hoping there will be more. Has it turned out as you expected? Did you have any expectations?
No, I'm just amazed that I did so much, and I sometimes think... I'm amazed I made a living out of it, and I did make a living out of it. I mean, it's...
Not many do.
Not many do, no. I think I've worked very hard, but I'm... I'm satisfied, really, that the books are there, and I'm pleased that most of them are in print, and those that aren't will probably come back into print, and I'm pleased about that. So,
and that people like Anna are reading them again?
Yes. I'm very always very pleased when I hear from a younger reader and feel that the books are still carrying on, because on the whole, the people who write to me are my own age group. But people sometimes come up to me and said, my mother loved your books and I read them too. It's very nice that.
I do think with mothers and daughters pass on literary habits and preferences in a rather delightful way. And I mean, I certainly with my own daughter, who's a great reader, you know, we have long conversations about particular books that we love, and she's forever finding things on my bookshelves that you know, I haven't read since I was in my 20s.
It's a good relationship through books.
I should add also, I mean, Margaret says she's not writing another novel, maybe, but she is writing for Slightly Foxed. And the summer issue is going to have her piece on the Water Babies.
I loved the Water Babies, and I was very pleased that Slightly Foxed let me write about it.
Yes, and talking of the quarterly, I mean, obviously, as regular listeners will know, Slightly Foxed is a literary quarterly magazine. It's a collection of pieces. I mean, they're all about a particular lost or forgotten or perhaps underappreciated book or writer. And they're all written by someone with a real passion for their chosen subject. And for anyone interested in books, I really would say that every issue it's a treat. And talking to Gail, you said there are 1,000 pieces.
Over 1,000 articles now, yes. And all available online for subscribers.
So if you
subscribe,
you can just trawl your way
Absolutely.
Through 1,000 of these wonderful
so
pieces.
So if, for example, like me, you've never got to the end of Proust.
We've discussed this before on the podcast.
They are a wonderful encapsulation of the novels, but also an inspiration to make you want to go and read them.
Yes.
And we've done that with Olivia Manning's two trilogies. We've done it with Patrick O'Brien's sequel of 20 Aubrey Maturin novels. And we're doing it again, actually, with George Orwell. We've got an article on Animal Farm in the current issue, and then there's one coming on 1984. We're not just revisiting things that have been forgotten, we're revisiting classics that you may want to revisit yourself.
What distinguishes them perhaps from ordinary reviews is just that they're very personal.
Because so they although bring they appear, the book idea, don't they? It's
yes,
not, you don't commission them.
No. Yeah. On the whole, not. They're informal, they're personal in approach, but my goodness, these people know their stuff.
But yeah, it's just an enthusiasm for that book, for whatever reason. You know, it might have amused you, it might have touched you, yeah, might have got you through a difficult moment.
I mean, Anna, have you got a one that you particularly enjoyed?
There was a piece, I think it was in issue 60, on Sir Gawain and the Green Knight.
Uh-huh.
As, I mean, I studied that at university and thought that I, you know, I had a very academic approach to it. And then reading this piece just makes you see it in a completely different way, and just it was kind of a rollicking good adventure.
So, you know, as you'll have gathered, it is an exceptionally diverse archive, and we've been talking about it and thinking we need to highlight it more, and I've been exploring it, and it's absolutely fascinating. We do think these pieces are really worth showcasing, so we include an extract in every episode of the podcast. We have a team of very talented and very generous actors and voice artists who read them for us. We really hope you enjoy them. Do let us know if you do. Gail, tell us what we've got for this month's extract and why you chose it.
The reading is an article about a novelist called Elizabeth Jenkins, who has been revived by Virago, but did for quite a long time rather fade from view. And it's about another woman's life work.
When she died in 2010, at the astonishing age of 104, the novelist and biographer Elizabeth Jenkins was all but forgotten. Her name known only to a few aficionados, her books mostly long out of print. And yet, in her day, her reputation had been up there with the other distinguished Elizabeths of mid-20th century fiction, Bowen and Taylor. What happened? I had never heard of Elizabeth Jenkins myself until a chance conversation with a bookseller friend. He told me he had just sold one of her books and was pleasantly surprised to find that she was still being read. Elizabeth who? I asked, and he gave me the basics. Since then, I found out and read much more and discovered for myself what a very fine novelist she was. A literary career that spanned 8 decades began soon after she left Cambridge. While still an unpublished author working on her first novel, she was invited to dinner by Virginia and Leonard Woolf and duly received the usual Bloomsbury treatment, taken up and made much of, then frozen out and humiliated. Though Virginia did praise that first novel, in somewhat patronising terms, a sweet white grape of a book, Elizabeth was so embarrassed by it that she sought out and bought up all the copies she could find. It was called Virginia Water, published in 1929, and it does indeed seem to have disappeared without trace. However, Victor Gallant was sufficiently impressed to offer her a 3-novel contract. Elizabeth Jenkins was on her way. Over the coming decades, a stream of well-received novels and equally well-received biographies poured forth. Several of the biographies, of Jane Austen — Jenkins was a founder of the Jane Austen Society — of Elizabeth I, Lady Caroline Lamb, and others, remain quite easily available to this day. But the novels, though they often went into several printings, are mostly much harder to find. In part, no doubt, this was a matter of changing fashions. Jenkins' novels generally inhabit an upper-middle-class milieu, and she strongly disapproved of the social changes that came about in the 50s and 60s. Things might have been different if she had been more of a self-publicist, or any kind of a self-publicist, but she was not. Held back by her diffident nature, she did little to further her career, shunning all publicity and self-promotion. In today's literary world, she would have sunk like a stone. Happily, however, those novels were not entirely forgotten. One of them, The Tortoise and the Hare, was republished as a Virago modern classic, and another, Harriet, was later reissued by Persephone Press. The Tortoise and the Hare was the first Elizabeth Jenkins novel I got my hands on, and I was not disappointed. It chronicles the breakup of a marriage, a familiar enough subject, but handled with rare imaginative flair and originality. Imogen is the beautiful, sensitive young wife of Evelyn Gresham, a handsome, brilliant, and successful barrister with a very high opinion of himself and a strong sense of entitlement, neither of which his compliant wife has done anything to dent. The Greshams have plenty of money, a big house in Berkshire, and a place in town, and a standard of living that might make today's readers blink in disbelief. But are they happy? Of course not. As the story unfolds, Imogen begins to realise just what is going on between her dazzling husband and the wildly improbable and therefore easily dismissed other woman, a tweedy, frumpy pillar of village society, spinster, wearer of ludicrous hats, but wealthy, capable, knowledgeable in practical affairs and strong-minded. It is in those last attributes, all of which Imogen lacks, that Blanche's fatal attraction lies. Imogen looks on in helpless agony, and worse, in full awareness that she is collaborating in her own suffering. There is an element of autobiography in The Tortoise and the Hare. Elizabeth Jenkins, a beautiful, sensitive woman herself, wrote it after being dumped by the love of her life, a married man every bit as distinguished as Evelyn Gresham. She was fatally attracted to such men, and they recur in her novels, as do sympathetic but frail victim figures. And victims don't come any frailer than the helpless title character of Harriet, Jenkins' second novel, which in 1935 beat Evelyn Waugh's A Handful of Dust to win the Prix Femina Vie Heureuse. Elizabeth Jenkins continued writing almost to the last, publishing a memoir, The View from Downshire Hill, in her 100th year. Downshire Hill in Hampstead was where she lived, in a Regency house that her father bought for her in 1939. She furnished it with good Regency furniture, picked up for next to nothing after the war, but could barely afford to heat a few rooms. Because of the furniture, she recalled, people assumed I was comfortably off, instead of being very hard up. Her small, hunched figure was a familiar sight on the streets of Hampstead for many years, but the distinguished and gifted author that was Elizabeth Jenkins had all but disappeared. When, in 1983, Virago issued a promotional booklet with pictures of all the modern classics authors. She was the only one of whom no portrait could be found. Instead, she appears in the leaflet as an outline head with a blank space.
It's very poignant, isn't it? The
whole thing. Very moving, yeah.
But Margaret, you and I were talking about her before we started recording, and you visited her at Downshire Hill.
I used to live just around the corner from her, and I went to tea there. I was quite frightened of her, but her house was like that. It was in a sort of time capsule, and very elegant and beautiful, but faded.
And what was she like?
She was a bit frightening. She was small and frightening. And I think we were talking about Jane Austen, and she reproved me on one or two points. She was probably right, but maybe not, I don't know. But she was quite authoritarian, really, and and despite her diffidence in other ways. That was a fascinating piece about her.
Isn't it? And I read it, and it did indeed lead me to read Harriet and The Tortoise and the Hare, and they are exceptionally good. I mean, Harriet is really dark. But yeah, I'd thoroughly recommend them. Have you read them, Anna?
I've read The Tortoise and the Hare, but I'm definitely going to move on to Harriet.
What did you think about Tortoise and the Hare?
I thought it was very refreshing. The kind of the dynamic between the women is also very refreshing, but also the darkness of it. I think you don't expect that necessarily with these kind of, as she was described, these kind of more shy, retiring, beautiful novelists, women novelists. But there's definitely this undercurrent that kind of runs through it, yeah. Which is quite appealing.
Because Imogen, the kind of helpless, beautiful wife, I mean, she's trapped in her own good behaviour, isn't she? Because this horrible neighbour, this overbearing neighbour, is stealing her husband, and it's transparent. This is what's happening, unbelievable as it seems. But she somehow, she's like a rabbit in a trap. She can't do anything about it, can she? That was from Nigel Andrews' piece on the writing life of Elizabeth Jenkins. It's from Slightly Foxed, issue number 60, and our thanks to the actress Fiona Hampton for reading it for us. Now, moving on, book recommendations we'll have shortly from everyone. First of all, though, a brief word about the Slightly Foxed Quarterly. Elegant, eclectic and entertaining, Slightly Foxed is the literary quarterly for nonconformists. It introduces readers to all those wonderful books that languish on publishers' backlists but are often very hard to find in bookshops. Among its contributors are distinguished writers and novelists and people from other walks of life, all of whom share their passion for particular books and authors and write about them beautifully. Now, since it's entirely independent, Slightly Foxed is free to follow its own nose and celebrate the offbeat. So why not take out a subscription? £48 for an annual print subscription in the UK and Ireland, and £56 overseas. Your subscription also includes free access to all the back issues in the digital archive. Here's the web address, foxedquarterly.com, or if you'd rather talk to a human, give the office a ring on 020 7033 0258. Thank you. So, recommended reads from everyone, please. Hazel, can we start with you?
Well, I would like to recommend Margaret's book, The Dark Flood Rises, which I've recently read and hugely enjoyed. It could be said it's to do with my age, but I think anybody of any age really would enjoy it, and I felt it might actually give younger people an insight into what it actually feels like to be older. It's about a group of friends and acquaintances, and the story is sort of held together by the heroine, Fran, who keeps herself busy as an inspector for a housing charity and also providing meals for her ex-husband, Claude, which she compulsively does, who's, you know, become sort of unable to do anything for himself, really, an ex-surgeon, and her close friend, Jo, who is an academic, who's found herself a cosy billet in a, I imagine, sort of sheltered housing in Cambridge, where she leads a kind of dignified life. The phrase was something like she had domesticated loneliness, was it? And that struck me as so true. As you get older, your little nest is terribly important. It's about how all these people are trying to sort of cope, really, with the fact that they're getting older, older than probably previous generations, and they have to find ways of dealing with it. And there are subsidiary characters like Bennett Carpenter, who I loved, who's written this book called The Reaper and the Wheat.
I think that's right.
Yes, about the Spanish Civil War. Yes. Yeah. And it's just that, apart from anything else, your observation of older people and also of the social scene is so absolutely dead on. I mean, there's a lovely scene where Fran is trying to decide to get up and she's just sitting in bed worrying about absolutely everything. It's the gradual process by which she kind of brings herself around, and then the phone rings and somebody's rung her, so, you know, that sort of connects her again to the world and she manages to get out of bed, and one's so familiar with that kind of thing. And I love Jo's Tuesday evening class and all the different people in it. It's got tremendous humour, but also there is this sort of inevitably lurking feeling of threat, really. So I would highly recommend it to anybody of any age.
Hats off, Hazel. Actually, describing a novel when you're sitting next to someone.
I do feel I do feel rather daunted describing it in front of Margaret.
Margaret, would you like to give us your own recommendation?
Yes, I would like to recommend Edith Wharton's The Custom of the Country, which is a very, very brilliant, sparkling book about a young woman from the Midwest who makes it in high New York society. I've read this book two or three times, and I can't remember how many husbands she has, but she's certainly on the up and up and up.
Okay.
And she's very, very fashionable. She's painted by fashionable painters, but she's kind of basically just a kind of hustler. She's very beautiful. She's so horrible to her husband, her first husband. Then the husbands get better, you know, as they get richer.
Does she divorce them or do they die?
She divorces them. But she's horrible to her child, which I can't quite forgive. But there's something about the sparkle and wit of this book. You can't help but admire her on her career upwards, and her mother and her father and her lovers. It's just a very brilliantly witty book about high society and how to get into it.
She sounds monstrous and irresistible.
Becky Sharp type.
Becky Sharp is absolutely right, but she gets away with it. And I think that Edith Wharton must have had Thackeray in mind. But it is a classic book, and every time you read it, you see something different.
And the name again?
The Custom of the Country.
Anna.
I'm finally tackling a book that I've been meaning to read for quite some time, which is The Unwomanly Face of War by Svetlana Alexievich. She is a Belarusian journalist, and she actually won the Nobel Prize in Literature in 2015. Her writing's often described as polyphonic or kind of documentary novels. The Unwomanly Face of War is an oral history of the Soviet women in the Second World War. But she's talking to them maybe 40 or so years later about their experiences. And so she records all of these conversations that she has with them and kind of coaxes out these tales from them. You know, she'll go and have a cup of tea with them, sit at the kitchen table, and these extraordinary tales come through. And interestingly, I mean, Svetlana Alexievich was born in 1948, so just after the war, and in this kind of time of victory, and that's how the war was always presented. But she's kind of cutting through it and just showing how kind of sickening and real and horrific it can
terrible
be.
Terrible experiences for
and
those
these,
women.
These very young women going out who were so young when they left and then kind of were then silenced, really. It was all kind of men's stories, men's voices. And she describes it as reading their voices. Although it's reportage, there's an art to it because she's kind of the way that she's presenting this non-fiction narrative. It's completely fascinating. It's different to anything I've really read.
Gail.
Well, I want to recommend, I'm afraid, it's a book that we've just reissued. And in contrast to Anna's recommendation, this is one woman's account of her life during the Second World War. She was an aristocrat, but not a well-off one. And when war broke out, her husband was posted to Palestine. But she soon discovered that although he could take his butler, stroke Batman, with him, he couldn't take his wife. And she was having none of this, so she joined him. And was quite quickly discovered by a one-eyed brigadier who made it his personal mission to deport her back to England. So she got shipped off to South Africa. She jumped ship, made her way back to Egypt, and she got a job, first of all working for SOE, and then subsequently for a general who in the end was supreme commander in the Mediterranean. She worked in Palestine and in Egypt. She was a shorthand typist and apparently a very good one, a very intelligent woman. She arranged flowers, she bought people razors when they'd lost them, find people beds. I mean, she did all the work behind the scenes, as well as a full day coding dispatches. They worked a 7-day week. They worked incredible hours. And all the while she was, her husband, I forgot to say, her husband was taken prisoner. And for 4 months, she didn't know what had happened to him. She was devastated. They were eventually reunited in 1944. But she continued working until the end of the war. So spirited, so vivacious, and my goodness, she had courage and guts. She had a pet mouse called Fuad and a parrot who survived the war. Fuad, unfortunately, got flattened by a filing cabinet that fell over.
Ooh, that's a sad end.
It's a diary, and my goodness, she was a remarkable person.
And the title?
To War with Whittaker. Whittaker was the name of her husband's butler. Her name was Hermione, the Countess of Ranfurly.
It sounds great, but I'm still a bit sad about the mouse.
Yes.
That's it for this month. Our thanks to Dame Margaret Drabble for being with us. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's been fascinating. visit the Slightly Fox website if you'd like to subscribe to the quarterly magazine and indeed to browse through that archive of 1,000 pieces that we've been talking about. Foxquarterly.com is the place to go for that. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please do take a moment, if you can, to review and rate us on whatever app you're listening to it on. We'll be back on April the 15th. And thanks, as always, for listening and for joining us on this month's literary expedition, Off the Beaten Track.